Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I am your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to help you stop counting calories, carbs, and fat grams so you can easily get to a healthy weight and get on with your life. How great would that be to wake up every morning and not get on that scale, not worry about what you're eating later, not worry about what you ate last night? How wonderful would it be to just wake up and think about what kind of a day you're going to have, not ever have to worry about being on another diet? Sounds good, right? Doesn't that sound amazing? I am here to help you do exactly that. So if you want to join me today, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. I would love to hear whatever is on your mind, whatever is weighing on you, whatever is eating at you. So it is January 2nd, 2019. Happy New Year, everyone. And I am so glad to be here with you today at the start of a new year. And let's talk a little bit more about New Year's resolutions. So last week, we talked about making a different kind of resolution. Instead of changing your behavior, like vowing that you're going to go to the gym 5 days a week or eat healthier. What does that mean exactly? It's kind of vague. I suggest doing something different. Resolve to change your relationship to yourself. Resolve to be kinder to yourself. Resolve to listen to your inner voice. Prioritize your needs and wants. Be curious instead of critical. That is one of my all-time favorite expressions. Be curious instead of critical. When you're critical, all you do is make yourself feel bad. And then when you feel bad, guess what? You are more vulnerable to later turn to food to feel better. So we don't want to do that. When you're curious, when you ask yourself questions, you are more likely to find answers. So what kind of questions am I talking about? Well, let's say you suddenly get a craving for cheesecake. So instead of vowing to be good, using willpower, telling yourself, do not eat the cheesecake, step away from the fridge, right? Instead of doing that, which is just being in battling with yourself and using willpower and just, it's just hard, right? Instead of doing that, ask yourself, here's the curious part, hey, why did I suddenly get a craving for cheesecake? What's going on with me? Why? Why cheesecake? Why now? Now, I have heard people say things like, well, I crave cheesecake because I really need calcium. No lie. I've heard this more than once. They tell me it's about physiology. It's about biology. It's my body's way of getting some calcium and protein. I've heard this with cheesecake. I've heard this with ice cream. You know, it's very creative, very, very creative. But the reality is that if your body craves calcium and protein, guess what? You'd probably crave milk, not cheesecake or ice cream. Another thing people say is, oh, well, I'm a sugar addict. I'm addicted to sugar. That's why I suddenly am craving cheesecake. So if you listen to the show or if you've listened for very long, you know I do not believe in sugar addiction. You sure can feel addicted, but you're not actually addicted to the substance of sugar. And a little later in the show, I'm going to give you some scientific reasons for why sugar addiction is not a real thing. And by the way, I shameless plug for my upcoming book, Beyond the Primal Addiction, which I co-edited with Salman Akhtar, Dr. Salman Akhtar. It's coming out in March, but you can pre-order it on Amazon. I write a whole chapter about quote-unquote food addiction. Okay, but let me get back to that later. Right now, let's go back to being curious and not critical. So ask yourself questions. Ask yourself, well, what was going on right before I got that craving for cheesecake or whatever it is that you're craving? If you're turning to food, remember, if you're turning to food, you are turning away from something else, most likely. For example, using food for comfort, for distraction. So let's say you're feeling anxious and you want cheesecake because it's going to distract you from that anxiety. It's going to make you feel better. Guess what? It is a lot easier to beat yourself up for eating cheesecake or focus on, I can't believe I ate that cheesecake. I can't believe I want to eat that cheesecake. It's a lot easier to focus on cheesecake than to process whatever it is that's actually making you anxious that's not cheesecake, or whatever's making you sad, or whatever is making you uncomfortable in any way. So here is what to do instead. Ask yourself, how would you respond to a child, a friend, or someone you love or care about if that person was feeling anxious or sad or upset in any way? Would you say, oh, I totally know just what to do. Let's get cheesecake. Let's get ice cream. Maybe if that's what you're going to say, then, you know, you need to keep listening. But if that is not what you would say, if you're thinking, no way, I would never say that to a friend or a child or someone I cared about, you'd probably say something different. You'd say, hey, you know, I'm sorry you're feeling bad. I totally understand why you feel this way. What do you need right now? How can I help? Let's talk about it. Do you need a hug? What's going on? So here's the thing. You got to talk to yourself as if you were a friend. Validate what you're feeling. Acknowledge there is a reason you're feeling this way. Remind yourself, and this is important, you've been through upsetting things in the past. You've been through anxiety-producing events in the past, and you have gotten through them. You have prevailed. You're here, and you can get through this too. So also, see what the situation means about you because you're feeling this way. Some people, sort of unbeknownst to them, have an internal dialogue along the lines of, you know, oh, how could I have been so stupid? How could I have let myself get into this situation? They turn on themselves. They make the anxiety worse. And by the way, it's not great for your self-esteem either. So you don't want to do that. Also, you could be thinking about the worst case scenario. If so, remember that what if is future-oriented fear. And if we can get lost in fear, we can get lost in fear. We can think that the thing that we're afraid of is really going to happen. And then we have real feelings in the present about a future that may or may not and probably won't exist. I mean, it may, but it may not. We don't know. That's why you got to stay with what is. So if you're in a what-if place, remember to go back to what is, which is reality. It's what you know. It's what you factually know to be true in the present. So stay here and now instead of escalating your anxiety by worrying about what possibly might happen in the future or what does this mean. Remind yourself that whatever you're feeling now, whatever you are feeling, you will stop feeling this way. There will be an end to it. Whatever the situation is, whatever you're worried about, you're going to get past this, and one day you're going to look back on it. You're not going to be stuck in these horrible, horrible feelings. Now, if something is making you anxious, if something is upsetting you, worrying you, give me a call. Let's talk about it. The number here in the studio, again, 818-602-4929. 818-602-4929. Start the new year out right. Give me a call and let's see what we can do to ease that anxiety or help you feel better so that you don't use food for comfort or to relieve stress or anything else to numb out. Well, you know what you know why you use it. There's another way, and I'm here to show you that other way. Okay, so earlier I mentioned food addiction. A lot of people think food addiction is real. In fact, in the last few years, there's been a lot of media coverage on this topic. And last year, I posted on a Facebook group. I said that when it comes to binge eating, psychological triggers are far more influential than food itself. And one reader on Facebook took offense at this and wrote that it was, quote unquote, a proven fact that sugar is as addictive as heroin. And by the way, this person is not alone in believing that sugar and heroin are equivalent, or that sugar is worse than heroin, more addictive than heroin. So it really seems that the notion of food addiction, especially sugar addiction, is accepted by the general public as scientifically factual, as is the idea of detoxing from sugar. You've probably heard a lot about detoxing, especially from sugar. Guess what? Our body has a natural detox process, and it's called elimination. So this notion of detoxification is also untrue. Any food eaten, even pure protein, can be converted into sugar in the body through the process of, I gotta look at this because it's, okay, gluconeogenesis. I don't even know how to say it. Gluconeogenesis. I can write it, but apparently I can't speak it. Gluconeogenesis is a metabolic pathway that results in glucose being generated from non-carbohydrate foods. So this is what I was telling Nicole last week when she called and she was talking about how carbs are bad and she's got to stay away. She's got to stay away from carbs, and how can she possibly lose weight if she eats carbs? And I told her that the body converts all food into carbs. And I forgot, because this is not a term that just sort of comes easily to my mind, gluconeogenesis. That is the process by which any food is turned into carbs in the body. But let's go back to what people think. There's a bestseller, the Case Against Sugar, says that sugar is not only addictive, it is the principal cause of obesity, diabetes, coronary heart disease, many other fatal diseases. Sugar is deadly. This book and others say that sugar is poisoning us. Sugar is making us obese and unhealthy. Well, I mean, it is making some people obese and unhealthy, but poison, I don't know about that. Because studies from the fields of neurology and obesity research have come to different conclusions. There are a lot of researchers who say, yeah, you know, food may, oh, hold that thought. Hi, caller, you're on with Dr. Nina.
Hi, Dr. Nina. Happy New Year. It's Nicole.
Hi, Nicole. Were you listening? I was just talking about gluconeogenesis, which is what I was trying to remember from last week. How are you doing? Happy New Year.
Yeah. I'm doing well. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
Did you do anything for New Year?
I did. I went to a party with my kids and my family, and we actually made it to midnight, which is a small miracle. So
yay!
It was fun. Yeah,
that sounds amazing. Yeah. So I was actually calling today with more of an expression. I learned something really cool this weekend. I went on a meditation retreat, like, for 3 days, and it was absolutely amazing, and it was called Elevate, and I learned something about food that really, really helped me, and I just wanted to share it with you and see what your thoughts were, too.
I would love to hear that.
We kind of learned to, like, elevate everything around us, including the food we eat, and to honor the food, and she had us, the group leader had us eat in silence and do everything in silence in order to just be more aware and, you know, to be more conscious. And it was crazy. I, like, sat down to eat breakfast the first day and just, like, paying attention to the texture and the color and the smell and just taking my time and eating slowly and sitting there and concentrating on the food and all that kind of stuff was just so different. Like, I didn't even eat half my breakfast because I was just, like, enjoying every bite and taking it all in and enjoying the experience. And it was just so, I don't know, it, like, just resonated with me. And it's something that I want to take into the new year with me and kind of just like along with everything you've taught me through like calling in every Wednesday and asking you questions and this, I just feel like so much like more at peace with food. And I don't know, I just want to be more alert and aware, and I don't know, it just feels really good.
Oh, that's, well, first of all, this deserves like a little yay. Wait a minute here. You know, I like my sound effects.
Yay!
All right. Okay. So
I love it.
First of all, it's wonderful that you had that experience. And I think the reason that you had that experience is because you, and you said it, you actually were able to enjoy what you were eating, and you weren't eating, you weren't feeling guilty. You weren't eating to avoid a feeling. You weren't eating to comfort yourself. You weren't having that, I shouldn't be eating this as you're eating it kind of experience, right?
Exactly.
You were doing what we're supposed to do with food, which is you were enjoying it.
Yes.
And it was only about nourishing your body. It wasn't about escaping something internal or comforting yourself or distracting yourself or any of those things.
And exactly. It's all those things.
And when you remember that, remember several weeks ago you called and you said you'd been to this Greek restaurant and you just couldn't figure out why.
Yeah.
Right. And I said, well, you were talking about how yummy it was. It was really delicious. And I told you, well, I think that you're not having enough delicious food. So when you have something delicious, you can't get enough. And that's why it's important when you eat something, don't eat something you don't like. Eat what you like and enjoy it.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. And do you remember last week I called and I was asking you, what should I eat? I don't even know what to eat anymore. And you're like, well, it's not what you should eat. What do you want to eat?
Right.
And something that I channeled while I was at the meditation retreat was like your voice. And I was kind of like, so they served really healthy food the whole time because it was like we were elevating ourselves and cleansing and whatever. So it was like all like super healthy food. And I like would come to the table and I would say, what do I want to eat? Not what should I eat?
I love all the healthy options.
What do I want to eat? So your voice was kind of in my head.
My voice was in your head. You're awesome.
your voice was in my head. And I was like, Nicole, what do you want to eat? So like I woke up in the morning and I usually don't eat there's this Greek yogurt I like called Faye, and I usually eat the 0%, but they only had the 2%, and I was like, I'm excited. I want to eat the 2%. And so I took the 2%, and like it was so creamy and so delicious. The first day I didn't even finish it. The second day I finished it, but I was like hungry, physically hungry. And I just want to be more in tune with what I want.
I love this. I love this. And look, 0% yogurt is, it's not as good as 2%, and 2% is really not bad, and you need fat anyway. Yeah. You need that.
Right.
We need balance. Many right. years ago, there were these cookies. I don't even know if they still make them. Snackwell's cookies, right? So this was in the fat-free days, like don't eat fat.
Yeah.
And so people made these, the Snackwell's, sorry to call them out, but that's the company that made them. They made these like sugar, the fat-free, but very, very sugary cookies. And people would eat them and then they couldn't stop eating them. So they'd end up eating way too many like low-calorie cookies and have way more calories than they would if they just had a Mrs. Fields or something. And the reason they were missing that feeling of a cookie, which cookies have fat in them. And so, you know, you have to have balance and it has to be good and it's okay.
Yeah.
It's good. Otherwise, you're going to make up for it in other ways.
Yeah, other ways, yeah. I realized that. Or some days, like I went to dinner with my dad one day and we went to dinner together and I ended up ordering a spaghetti. I had like a soup and salad to start and then I had a spaghetti. I was like craving spaghetti. I had spaghetti. I had a seafood spaghetti, so I ate mostly the seafood and a little bit of the spaghetti, and the next day I even felt lighter and thinner because I didn't overeat. I was satisfied. I was
satiated, and like, it was fine.
Yes. So this is exactly what I mean when I say have what you're, if your body is feeling like, okay, I want some carbs and I want some spaghetti and you know, seafood, then you have, then you can decide how much of it you want. When you're eating it because, and feeling guilty, then it becomes, I better eat this now because I'm never going to eat it again until I lose X pounds. And then you eat too much of it and the cycle continues.
Yeah.
So this is a wonderful way for you to start off the year. This
is
great.
I know, it feels so good. And I'm practicing every day. So, so I think that should help. I want to ask you one thing, but I don't know if it's TMI for the radio.
Well, I guess we'll find out. Nothing is TMI for the radio. I mean,
are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I see a therapist weekly, and I don't know. I told her all the things I call into the radio and tell you. And she basically told me that, like, I borderline have an eating disorder. And then on this meditation retreat, I was, like, talking to my friend about it. And she's like, a therapist is not supposed to, like, diagnose you like that or, like, tell you you have a problem.
Well.
And I don't know. She was telling me that my therapist is, like, messing me up and that I don't have a problem and that, like, it's normal and, like, you know, in LA, we're just, like, all, like, you know, obsessed with our bodies and, like, I don't know. I just wanted to get your take on it because now it's questioning my relationship with my therapist and whether I should continue with her. And it does make me feel bad when she tells me, like, I have an eating disorder. Then it makes me feel like I do have an eating disorder. I don't have an eating disorder.
Well, I think there's no doubt. There's no doubt that you have a complicated, painful, or have had a complicated, painful relationship to food. But first of all, therapists do diagnose, absolutely. But it's not like it's not like you have this. It should be like, okay, I think, you know, I'm concerned about you because I think you have some features of an eating disorder or you have some features of disordered eating. Let's, you know, what do you think? How can I help you?
Yeah.
What, you know, is this something you want to work on? Kind of a thing.
Yeah.
I think to normalize your relationship to food as this is LA and everyone thinks this way is to minimize it. Right, because this is something that has caused you conflict and made you feel bad about yourself and affected your self-esteem. So whether you call it an eating disorder or not, it doesn't sound like you have enough, but it doesn't sound to me, based on our conversations, that you have a clinically diagnosable eating disorder. But you have.
Yeah.
But you have a complicated, disordered relationship to food, right? But who cares what the label is? It's like, okay, what are your fears? What are your hopes? What's going on and why? So it's not just about what's your behavior? How do we diagnose your behavior? It's about what does it mean? What is it? What is it doing for you? How is it hurting you?
Right.
Let's look at that.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah, I just hate the labels. And she's like, why is she telling you you have a problem? So, yeah, now it's making me question my relationship with her. But I guess you're telling me that. Well, she didn't say I have an eating disorder. She said exactly what you said. She said I have characteristics or, like, borderline or, some disordered eating. She didn't say you have an eating disorder.
Right. And let me clarify, therapists, psychologists, social workers, marriage therapists, psychoanalysts like me, we do diagnose. That's our whole point. We diagnose people. Now we don't.
Are you an MD, Dr. Nina?
No, I'm a doctoral doc. Whoops.
Doctoral.
Yeah. So no, I'm not an MD doctor. I have a doctorate in psychology. So.
But you guys can diagnose.
Yes, we diagnose. We do diagnose. Okay. We absolutely diagnose. So there's a whole... So your friend was incorrect by telling you that your therapist should not diagnose you. A therapist, her job is to say, hey, I think this is something that is of concern. Yeah. Let's look at this.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess I was saying, in terms of food, is it better, like, not to diagnose it and, like, make it like a bigger thing that it may actually be, because then I feel like I have that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like she's like, just don't make it such a big deal. Like, it's normal. We all like, she likes cookies. So she was saying like I ate a box of cookies one day, and that's okay. Like, she said her therapist told her that, like, we all eat cookies sometimes. Like, it's fine. Like, yeah. Move on.
Well, wait.
You know?
Nah. Look. No, we don't all eat a box of cookies. If you're eating a box of cookies to relieve, we all eat cookies for sure. We should all eat cookies, right? Or ice cream or cheesecake or whatever. We should. We should have some, you know, treats. However, if you're eating those cookies to relieve something psychological, then it's not good. Then it is a negative coping strategy, and it is and it needs to be addressed, not in a pathologizing way, like, oh my God, you ate cookies, you know, a box of cookies, but in a, okay, you ate a box of cookies, I wonder why. Curious, not critical. What was going on with you that made you decide that this was, you know, what were you trying to resolve? Because food is the food is the solution to the problem. It is not the problem. And that is why it doesn't matter what the, you know, bulimia, you know, binge eating, anorexia, whatever it is really secondary to, well, what's motivated? That's just for, those diagnoses are for insurance companies to reimburse people, which they don't do anymore, which they don't even do anymore. Yeah. So it's really like, like, you're not an eating disorder. You're Nicole, and you're struggling occasionally with food, and that needs your attention with your therapist.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much. I feel like I want to say one more thing. Is that okay?
Of course, yes. Go on. Of course.
Okay. So the retreat was awesome, and then I came home yesterday, and I was feeling good. And, you know, they tried to have us eat mostly, like, plant-based foods. So we had, like, halibut the first night that was, like, delicious. It was, like, with roasted fennels and baby tomatoes, and it was so healthy and delicious. But then yesterday I came home and my sister ordered like kebabs, like Persian food, like kebabs. And I hadn't had meat in like, I don't know, chicken or beef in like 4 days. And so I just overdo it, but I ended up eating, you know, a piece of beef and a piece of chicken. And I had some, you know, like salad, like cucumber and tomatoes diced. And then I had like, I didn't eat rice, but like she ordered this cherry rice. So I ate a little bit of the cherries in it. And I kind of felt guilty, so I ended up having
Why did you feel guilty?
I know I said I was working on this weekend, but I was aware while I was eating the food.
Okay, so I'm glad you brought this up, because this is a perfect example of how deprivation leads to wanting more, even when it comes to healthy food. So if you are used to eating animal protein or chicken or fish or beef or whatever on a regular basis, and then you don't eat it for 4 days, your body is going to crave it. And so rather than feel guilty, just remember it there's no good food or bad food. There's just food. And then you can choose what your body needs with a little bit of, you know, something for a treat. You need to have something. We need to have dessert every once in a while. We're supposed to enjoy food.
So
I hope that helps. Remember, no good food, no bad food.
Yeah, okay. Then I ended up having the chocolate after, but it was delicious and I enjoyed it. But I feel like, not that I feel bad about it, but I'm like, oh, I would have been skinnier today if I didn't eat that.
And that's...
But I guess it's fine.
And you know what? That's not true. Eating some chocolate did not keep you from losing weight.
Okay. Thank you so much. I feel good. Thank you for allowing me to call and providing this channel to express and ask questions and for being my support.
Oh, and you're so welcome.
I love you, Dr. Nina.
Oh, thank you, Nicole. I'm so happy to hear that you're making these changes, and that I can hear you're really feeling better, and just keep up the good work.
Okay, thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, I feel so warm and fuzzy inside. She had my voice in her head, and she felt better. That makes me happy. Okay, where was I? I was on sugar addiction. So Okay, so here's the theory behind sugar addiction. It's the reward theory, which is that there is a correlation between specific foods with increased dopamine levels. Dopamine is the chemical that mediates pleasure and motivation in our brains. So the basic theory of food addiction is that sugar and other foods activate the release of dopamine. People eat sugar, get a dopamine rush, feel good, and then they have to eat increasing amounts of sugar to get the same experience they previously felt with less. So food addiction theory points to changes in the brain, specifically higher levels of dopamine, as evidence of sugar addiction. Sounds plausible, right? But wait. There are a lot, and I mean a lot, of other studies that refute this idea. Oh, here's a call, another call. Hold that thought. Hi, caller, you're on with Dr. Nina.
Hey, Dr. Nina. Brian from Chicago. How are you?
Hi.
Happy New Year.
Hi, Brian. Happy New Year to you. Good to hear from you.
You too. Off to a great start with another wonderful show.
Thank you.
So my question actually stems from something that happened over the holidays. I was at a party, and I overheard a friend talking a little bit about his mom, who's an older woman now, and that he and the other folks who know his mom were expressing some concern with the way she eats, the way she deals with food, that she is very, like, restrictive in the way she eats, that she gets herself incredibly stressed out and depressed over, you know, the fact of eating. And they've tried to bring it up to her a few times, and she doesn't receive it very well. She kind of denies that there's an issue, or just says, I'm fine, or, you know, gets a little challenging to talk to when it gets brought up. So I'm just wondering what advice you might have for how to, you know, address that with her if you were, you know, one of her family or friends.
Oh, that's a good question, Brian. I'm asked some variants of this question a lot. Like, you know, how do I help my husband, wife, mother, father, whoever, friend who's got food issues but doesn't want to talk about it? So there's first the kind of typical things I recommend, like say to them, look, this is not about what you're eating. It's I'm worried about your health. I love you. I want you to feel well. I want you to be healthy in all ways. And usually what happens is then they get shut down, right? And it's, don't worry, I'm fine. I don't want to talk about it. And I don't know if your friend did this, but that's when they give up. And that's exactly the point where you have to persist. So when someone says what did you say? His mom was just like, I'm fine. I don't want to talk. I'm fine. Don't worry about me.
Sometimes the sense I got is that maybe there's also, you know, a little bit of a strong pushback where I think it's safe to say people maybe feel hesitant to talk about it any further because it looks like maybe an argument's about to break out and everybody's just trying to keep the situation calm and relatively peaceful.
Okay, so that's when the mom is probably just saying something along the lines of, I don't want to talk about it, leave me alone, right? And that's when her son, your friend, probably leaves her alone. Instead of doing that, that's the point when you press more, but in a very specific way. So I talk about the SET approach, S-E-T approach, as a way of being able to talk to anybody about anything. Because then what you say, so situation, emotion, translation. So your friend could say something like, Mom, when I bring up my concerns about your health and you refuse to talk about it, right, that's the situation, then the emotion. I feel, you know, dismayed, I feel worried, I feel dismissed, I feel, you know, whatever it is that he's feeling, I'm worried, frustrated. And then T stands for translation, which is, what does it mean? What does the situation mean? So mom, when you shut me down, I feel these feelings because it means you're not taking my concern for you seriously. You don't care that I am worried about you. And that deepens the conversation. Now she might just say, I just don't want to talk about it. And you say, then you're dismissing me. When you dismiss me, I feel this because it means that, right? And you just keep doing it. And does that make sense?
It makes sense. I'm wondering if it works for, and I don't know that this is the case, but how effective is it if you introduce that dynamic into a relationship that's literally never seen that dynamic before, where nobody's used to either saying that or having that said to them? You know, what advice do you have if it just feels sort of unnatural to them, or it feels like, wow, we've never really spoken to each other like this, so,
well,
you know,
then it's about time
as to where it's going to go.
It's about time to start. I mean, then I'd say, yeah, it's scary to be more real. It's scary to talk about what you feel and think. If you've never done it and you've always had a very surface kind of relationship with your family, it is different and it is scary, but avoiding it is not going to change anything. The only hope of changing anything is to do something different. You know, if you want to make a change, you can't keep doing the same old things. If you want, change only happens outside of our comfort zones, as the saying
right.
goes. So, yeah, acknowledge that it will be uncomfortable. Oh, well, right? Either your friend's going to be worried about his mom, and just then he carries all this worry, and it's going to affect the way he feels towards her, about her. He's going to be thinking about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's going to affect him either way. He can either suffer in silence, or he can have a difficult but important conversation with her.
So it's the buckle up buttercup school of thought.
Well, it's buckle up buttercup. Yes, it's the buckle up buttercup, but not in the way that he should speak to her. He's not going to give her tough love. He's going to give himself tough love and say to himself, okay, I don't want to do this. Buckle up, buttercup. And then go and talk to his mom using the situation emotion translation.
Okay.
And
so this is kind of a related question, not to take up a ton of your time.
No,
this is sort of a related question that just kind of pops up to my head as I'm listening, which is, what if you have somebody like my friend's mom in the family, and they're dealing with these issues, but they never really talk about them, and you never really, you know, you haven't, like, spent a ton of time watching them at a table full of food. Are there warning signs that, you know, if you were just simply somebody who kind of passes in and out of their life, that if you see them, hey, that may mean something? If nobody is disclosing that there's any kind of issue, or they're not talking about things in a way that indicates there might be an issue, but just certain things that, you know, observation should suggest might be a problem.
Like what? Give me an example.
Well, like, let's say it's not your relative, so you don't really see them a lot, but, you know, just certain things where if you see them at a party and you see a certain kind of behavior, hey, that couldn't, they might be having some body dysmorphia issues, or they might be having some sort of issues related to eating disorder, and maybe, you know, maybe there's something there that might lead to some sort of harm on their part. Just like warning signs, if they're not coming out and saying, you know, I'm having an issue, or they're not obviously having an issue, but just sort of more subtle hints that the average person would see and say, you know what, maybe there's something that needs to be dealt with.
Well, yes. I mean, maybe with binge eating disorder, it's hard to say, because not everyone who eats a lot at a holiday party has binge eating disorder, and you can't tell if someone has binge eating disorder by what they weigh. A lot of people are normal weight with binge eating disorder, and a lot of people are overweight and they don't have binge eating disorder. So you can't just go by appearance alone. But if you notice things like people eating a lot and then going to the bathroom every single time, or, you know, losing a lot of weight all of a sudden and there's no you know, there's nothing going on with them, that they're not sick or anything like that, or gaining a lot of weight. Those are warning signs, or just people saying, I ate beforehand and you know, I'm not hungry, and then not eating. Those are all sort of warning signs of different types of eating disorders. But, you know, generally people will say something. They'll apologize. They'll give you an opening like, oh, I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm just so hungry. Or, oh, I just, you know, they'll apologize, or they'll make a comment about it, and that gives you a doorway, right? Oh, you know, I notice you're apologizing for what you're eating. What, you know, what's going on with you and food? Are you worried, or are you, you know, I mean, you can find a way to do it. And just remember, whatever's going on with food is not the problem. It's the answer to the problem.
Right. Okay. That totally makes sense. I really appreciate your time and the opportunity to talk to you, as always.
You're very welcome. Oh, so just one more thing I want to add, that if you know something is going on in their life and you see them dealing with it with food, or you think they are, instead of, you can bypass the whole what's going on with you and food. You can just go to, how are you resolving this problem, or what's going on with this situation in your life? You can talk to them about whatever it is that may be the true root problem that's causing this way of coping.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Cool. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Happy New Year, and I'm glad to talk to you again. It's been a while.
Yeah.
No pressure.
I look forward to getting back.
Call when you can. All right. Bye, Brian. Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You bet. Bye.
Sometimes people call often, and then they suddenly don't call, and I think, well, what happened to that person? But then they call back. So always good to hear from the regular callers, and always good to hear from new people. So if you want to give me a call now. No time like the present. What time is it? Oh, we have about 8 minutes left to the show. 818-602-4929 is the number. Okay, so I was talking about sugar addiction. There is a nutrition researcher and neurobiologist named Stefan, Guenet. I'm butchering names today. Basically, he reminds us that diet and lifestyle factors such as excessive calorie intake, physical inactivity, cigarette smoking, alcohol, illegal drug use, all contribute to disease. And he further notes that most of the diseases are not correlated with sugar intake. And he also says, and this is the most important, sugar intake has actually been declining in the last 2 decades, which is the same period of time that obesity and diabetes rates have dramatically increased. So, sugar does change our brains, as do certain drugs. So does spending time with friends, playing games, sex, shopping, any other pleasurable activity that we do also raises the dopamine levels in our brains. There was a study in 2011 that showed listening to classical music had the same impact on our brains as cocaine. Amazing, right? So our brains also react differently to sugar than to drugs like cocaine or heroin. So in research studies with rodents, think rats, who were given cocaine, their dopamine levels surged but did not return to baseline. They needed more and more and more drugs to maintain the baseline dopamine levels. But that is not what happens with sugar. With sugar, the dopamine levels go up, and yet they go back to baseline level. Also, the studies that confirm rats showing more addictive behavior for sugar than drugs are very misleading. Humans are motivated by psychology, not just biology. But rats are motivated by survival. Rats do not turn to food to soothe hurt feelings, to numb themselves, to distract from what's going on in their lives. Rats are primarily food-seeking, and sugar is food. So naturally, they choose sugar over drugs like heroin or cocaine. In fact, there have been studies that show this animal model of sugar addiction are baseless and say there is zero support for the notion of sugar as addictive. So another study a couple of years ago found that, this is a quote from the study, addiction-like behaviors such as binging occur only in the context of intermittent access to sugar. These behaviors likely arise from intermittent access to sweet-tasting or highly palatable foods, not the neurochemical effects of sugar. So when you only have it sometimes, you want it more. And this study also differentiated between sugar per se on its own and sugary foods, which usually contain fat. And they made the point that most people do not eat spoonfuls of sugar, but they have food that contains sugar. So it's not that they're addicted to sugar. If people were addicted to sugar, they would eat spoonfuls of sugar. And these researchers also noted the difference between cravings for food and for drugs. Food cravings are relatively short-lived. They subside after a while, as opposed to drug cravings, which persist and do not lessen in intensity with abstinence. Here's something else that might surprise you. This is a study in 2017. Researchers said sugar does not seem to contribute to weight gain more so than other sources of energy in the diet. Instead, the current scientific community nowadays seems to reach the consensus that food addiction and its role in weight gain might be better explained by eating dependence as a result of the unique individual experience with food and eating instead of being caused by a specific food. So translating that is using food with sugar or not, using food to comfort, using food to soothe, using food to resolve something internal or psychological. So that's why when you start focusing on why you're eating instead of what you're eating, you're going to find that these sugar cravings go away. When you let yourself have sugar and know that you can have it, then you can decide whether or not you want it. The intermittent sugar cravings thing that I talked about before, that was when people were sort of like, I shouldn't have it, I'm going to have it. I shouldn't have it, I'm going to have it. But if you say, I can have it, then you can decide, A, if you want it, and B, how much. Okay, so last week, how much time do we have? Only a couple more minutes. I'm gonna start on this. I started last week to share some tips on how to process emotions, because people say, okay, Dr. Nina, I get it. If I'm using food to process my feelings or escape my feelings, but I don't know any other way of processing my feelings, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to be that friend to myself. What do I do? So I'm going to give you some tips from Deepak Chopra. He says, it is not easy to deal with painful emotions head on, but it's a key to good health and well-being physically, mentally, and spiritually. If we don't deal with pain when it occurs, it will resurface as compounded emotional toxicity later on, showing up as insomnia, hostility, and anger or fear or anxiety. And this is me interjecting, eating your feelings. So, I'm going to leave off right here because we only have less than a minute left in the show. Next week, tune back in. I'm going to talk more about Deepak Chopra's guide to how to process your feelings and give you some of my own thoughts on the matter as well. And I would love to hear what's going on with you, and let me help you process your feelings on air. So that is that's it for the first show of the year. Thank you so much for joining me here on the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio. I am so glad to spend this hour with you. If you like the show, please please take a moment to write a review on iTunes. All you have to do is go to iTunes Podcasts and do a search under The Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio and give me a review. It would mean so much to me. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next week. Bye.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.